Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This is a really special and exciting show. In February, the Lannan Foundation decided that it would put together a tribute to Walt Whitman. And it didn't want anything academic or staid. It wanted to celebrate our most indecorous poet with our own forms of indecorum. And here I am with the three poets involved. Those are Major Jackson, whose most recent book of poetry from Norton is Hoops, Eamon Grennan, whose most recent book of poetry from Grey Wolf is Matter of Fact, and Patty Ann Rogers, whose most recent book is Wayfair. That's from Penguin. Now, here we are, and I want to begin by saying and confessing, you know, that when I got to college, I was not a practiced reader of poetry, and Whitman turned me on. He was the man for me. I couldn't believe what I was finding there. I found that my eyes couldn't go all the way across the page. The lines are so long, so I started to read out loud. And when I started to read out loud, I started to like it and walked out in the hallway and walked across the campus sort of Pied Piper style, reading mostly not to students but to the runaway kids who used to crowd around the ground floors of the dormitories. And then eventually we all sat on an elevator going up and down, reading all of Song of Myself till I was finished. And I swear to you, by the end of it, I'd stopped wanting to be a business math major, which is what my parents wanted, and I knew I was an English major. That was what Whitman did to me. Can you tell me, Eamon, Whitman is pretty new to you. You
new and novel, Michael. I like your term. Turn me on, because Whitman is a drug, clearly, and we're all under his influence by the time you have a few puffs. And I have been inhaling Whitman for the last 6 months, basically, because before that I really didn't. Being Irish, Whitman. Whereas Whitman was very important to lots of the major Irish poets in the early stages of the Irish Renaissance and so on, he wasn't part of my upbringing at all in the way he would be in America. So it's very recent for me, and I've been nose to the Whitman grindstone for quite some time. But it's been extraordinary, because it is, like I said in some of my remarks to people, it's like walking to the edge of the Pacific and having to keep walking and walk in. And Whitman is all around you. He is such an immense body of poetry in every sense.
Well, you'll all recognize the next time you hear Eamon's voice. He's the Wickmaniac with the brogue. And now, Patty Ann, how did you encounter Whitman?
Well, you know, it wasn't when I was young, and not even very much in college, but afterwards. And I guess what I, the things that have meant a lot to me about Whitman were the celebratory tone of his voice, and also, this is an overword used right now, but the inclusion. I mean, everything is there in Whitman, and whoever you are, whatever age, whatever gender, whatever nationality, you will find yourself in Whitman. I mean, your word, the word of you in Whitman. And I think early you know, as a grade school student, I think, oh, Captain, my Captain, and the fact that he's always called an American poet, which, of course, he is, but he's cosmic. He is absolutely cosmic. He has a view and a vision not of a locality on earth, but of the whole heavens and the whole universe and where he is and who he is. And that is all infectious and stimulating and encouraging and uplifting and optimistic and accepting. And so that, and also the fact that he knows how to do a list. He knows the power of a list, the repetition in the list, and how to do it. And that is something I have wanted my own poetry to do. So in those ways, he's been, and others, which are too numerous to mention right now, have been very important to me.
So you recognize Patty Ann Rogers. She's the woman.
Right. Whitman has some nice things to say about mothers and women.
We're being stereotyped here. I don't know. Where do we get to
But I'm hoping that... the thing that I did want to say, I was realizing in this time reading, you know, Whitman's inclusiveness, it was the first time that I understood that Whitman thinks he's running for office. And if he doesn't mention you, you won't vote for him. He really is part of the American con man tradition, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact of the matter is...
Carnival Barker.
That, yeah. And you know, he wants you to elect him as... Walt Whitman of America.
The American poet.
You know,
he's running for that
you.
Office.
And not so, the American poet. He's running for the universe.
Yes,
poet
that's
of
very
the
true.
Universe.
Now, Major, when did you encounter Whitman?
My encounter with Whitman was a result of me apprenticing myself to American poets and realizing increasingly that we're all here are, as popularly said, children of Whitman. It was reading people, of course, like Ginsberg, but also Galway, Philip Levine, C.K. Williams. And I guess what I was attempting to mimic that I realized that they had borrowed from Whitman was that casting of the long line and the ability to incorporate all of oneself and all of one's observations, all of one's experience into this kind of lush line. And it was an enormous realization for me, because once you read one line of Whitman, you just keep going. I mean, you can't stop at any particular place until you've ingested all of him. And as some of his early readers experience that moment of enlightenment, that you are elevated beyond your experiences, yet also grounded in that experience as well. I call him the first rapper. Because he rapped about the city, you know, rapped about America.
No rapper has that kind of breath.
No, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
But I wondered, tell me, as you were reading, I mean, we get to, I guess, around section 6 or 7, and Whitman has invited a runaway slave, and he's feeding him and nursing him back to health. But then we go on, and Whitman is thrusting a slave auctioneer off the block and saying, "Let me do this, and I'm going to show you my voice." What did you feel as an African-American reading Whitman?
Well, it was more in that moment and subsequent moments of I Seen the Body Electric, in which there was an affirmation of humanity. Despite this person's circumstance, he really is dignifying the body, dignifying a body that had been denigrated vis-a-vis American slavery enterprise, and also women. I mean, he really is saying that these are fathers, these are mothers, these are more than just laborers on your fields.
Promise.
So it wasn't a contradiction. I think there was something enormously generous about that particular moment. It wasn't problematic reading that particular section at all.
Is that, you know, what Toni Morrison does, where one of the critical moments in Beloved is where Little Suggs, I think, gives the sermon
by
on the
lake.
Body, about claiming the body.
That's right.
Reclaiming. That was pure Whitman, I thought. And it was from the other side, basically. Mm-hmm. It is the person on the block talking, in that case, about reclaiming the body. And I think Whitman did that not only for African Americans, but he did it for women. He did it for sexual 19th century America. Mm-hmm. And I'd even go further to say he did it for sexual 19th century England, Ireland, mm-hmm. and Europe, mm-hmm. because an enormous amount of his influence when he was denigrated in this country came from England. And he himself said in about 1882 or 3, it's amazing, he said, how many of my books are called for from Ireland? Mm. And you think, Ireland, you know? And Yeats actually said, we've got to do for Irish literature what Whitman has done for America. Mm. This is in the 80s.
And not only that, but gay men all over the globe.
Exactly.
In fact, it perturbed Whitman. John Addington Symonds, having, you know, been aroused by Calamus, right. Wrote to
writes
Whitman.
Writes him, yes.
And Whitman writes back. He's really surprised.
Yeah, right.
And he says, I've never been married or lived with anyone, but I have fathered
I have
six
children.
Right.
Yeah. I have children.
But they never found those children. I don't think they ever found. But, you know, also, Whitman, at the time when he was writing, there was still quite a belief in the division between the body and the soul. And Whitman makes a great point of saying this is a false dichotomy. They are both, mm-hmm. they are one. And that comes up again and again in his poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talking about his influence outside of America, you know, I don't know if you knew or probably did that Van Gogh's Starry Night was influenced by Whitman.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
There are letters to both his sister and his brother, and he was reading Whitman at the same time that he painted Starry Night.
Wow.
And even said, this is my only painting with a poetic interpretation or something. He used the word poetic. And he had been recommending Whitman to his friends, and he said the English were reading a great deal of him and speaking about him. And
That was the 1871 edition, I think, and that was what Rossetti edited it or something. I don't know who that Rossetti was, but in England, and that's the one that caught on, and that's when Whitman's star rose in Europe and for Van Gogh, obviously.
And literally, what too? Because
Literally.
Because of Starry Night is full of the kind of energy
that
Whitman
right.
talks about.
Electric.
When he, you know, he talks about the stars and night quite a bit in his work.
Yeah. Oh, actually, if you'll let me interrupt, because this is the perfect place. Can you give us, Major? When I heard The Learned Astronomer, because this is the perfect place for the poem, okay?
Yes.
Because we have to hear a little of Whitman's voice.
Correct.
Okay, right.
Here we go.
That's good.
Good.
Well, some of you were introduced to Whitman in school with Captain. For me, the poem that came to me as a high school student was when I heard The Learned Astronomer. And it's a poem, very short poem, which was joyous for me. But it was something I considered at that time an appropriate classroom poem for me, because it articulated just exactly what I was feeling sitting there listening to my teacher. When I heard The Learned Astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became, tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars.
It's great.
It's elegant.
It's great.
It's very elegant.
Totally. And again and again, like Patty Ann says, and this poem suggests, Whitman moves from down here to up there. And it's that range that we're so amazingly entranced by, it seems to me. Certainly when I'm reading Whitman, I'm looking for that and I'm finding it all over the place. You know, so even after that poem in my little edition here, after The Learned Astronomer and the Stars, is this tiny little thing with three lines called A Farm Picture. Listen. So he's bitten with the stars. Next poem. Through the ample open door of the peaceful country barn, a sunlight pasture filled with cattle and horses feeding, and haze and vista and the far horizon fading away.
Lovely.
Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah. Well, let me,
you know, and that's, it's that, you know, I mean, I embrace multitudes, you know.
I want to read another one.
Please, yeah.
Because this also goes, I think, follows those two well, and it's very short. A Clear Midnight.
Oh, yeah.
This is thy hour, O soul, thy free flight into the wordless, away from books, away from art, the day erased, the lesson done. Thee, fully forth emerging, silent, gazing, pondering the themes thou lovest best, night, sleep, death, and the stars.
Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you got astronomer, farm, and soul.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's unbelievable.
It's amazing how he validates elemental experience through and through each one of his poems.
And he keeps saying yes is the point.
Yes.
But
it's a rich inside yes. It's not just Carlyle or whoever the other fellow was.
It's a bodily yes.
It's a huge bodily, soulful yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking happily to Major Jackson, to Eamon Grennan, and to Patty Ann Rogers, the perfect camarados to talk about Walt Whitman. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Patty Ann Rogers, Eamon Grennan, and Major Jackson in a tribute to Walt Whitman. And I thought that this program also needs to be complete to hear some of the poems by yourselves that you feel to be influenced in some way by Whitman. Would you like to read a poem, Patty Ann?
You want me to read my own first, or
just your own?
Okay, all right. I'm going to read a poem that I think has some. I don't want to say imitating, and I don't want to say influenced. Maybe the word connection with Whitman, and that it has a listing to it. Well, let me just go ahead with it, because also, you know, Whitman. God comes into Whitman. Spirituality is there at some level in almost everything. So this, the title of this poem is, In Addition to Faith, Hope, and Charity. I'm sure there's a God in favor of drums. Consider their pervasiveness, the thump, thump, and slide of waves on a stretched height of beach, the rising beat and slap of their crests against shore baffles. The rapping of otters cracking mollusks with stones, woodpeckers beak banging, the beaver's whack of his tail paddle, the ape playing the bam of his own chest, the million tickering rolls of rain off the flat leaves and razor rims of the forest. And we know the noise of our own inventions, snare and kettle, bongo, conga, big bass, toy tin, timbals, tambourine, tom-tom. But the heart must be the most pervasive drum of all. Imagine hearing all together every tinny snare of every heartbeat in every jumping mouse and harvest mouse, sagebrush vole and leash shrew living across the prairie. And add to that cacophony the individual staccato tickings inside all gnatcatchers, kingbirds, kestrels, rock doves, pine warblers, crossing, crisscrossing each other in the sky. the sound of their beatings overlapping with the singular hammering to the hearts of cougar, coyote, weasel, badger, pronghorn, the ponderous bass of the black bear, and on deserts, too, all the knackings, the flutterings inside wart snakes, whiptails, racers, and sidewinders, earless lizards, cactus owls. Plus the clamors undersea, slow booming in the breasts of beluga and bowhead, uniform wrappings in a passing school of cod or bib, the thitterings of bat rays and needlefish. Imagine the earth carrying this continuous din, this multifarious festival of pulsing thuds, stutters, and drummings wheeling on and on across the universe. This must be proof of a power existing somewhere, definitely in favor of such a racket.
Bravo.
Patty Ann Rogers, you are magnificent.
Royal Whitman.
Multifarious.
That was great, Patty.
Thank you.
Major, let's hear you.
Sure. I'm talking about that capacious breath. Great. I'll fly away. I am best when I'm running full-throated towards the white caps in Truro, piping my woeful tune swell upon swell, keeping company with the red-winged blackbird who my ancient friend Jerry once said governed these parts with his running mate, the dusty miller. One ruled by land, the other by sea. One painted the air with swoops and trills and praised shafts of light. The other buried himself in sand, imitating tyrants, cursing the vast tongue of the ocean. This was years before Henry James in the Mayflower and the founding of the ballot, and years before William Bradford established his alehouse on Maine in Provincetown. Today, I run the shoreline with my neighbor's collie, blessing his dumb search for wet bark with a little jaunt of my own, exchanging dirges of our common dream of flight, my arms thrown back to lift my cape-like towel, thinking what would it have been like if there had been no footprints to study the way back to my beloved grief, if children had not waved my journey through seaweed and spindrift, if I would have lived all day watching schooners and barges edge toward Brooklyn, sipping my sweet glass of tea, dozing off from time to time, breaker phone lapping at my tired black feet. There was never a sound beside the sea except one, and that was my long sigh the horseshoe crab heard as a whisper. And there was never a shadow sprawled above, Truro large as the one I cast, the retired governor saw as a crow. Little Orville and little Wilbur Wright must have jogged on a beach like this one, enraged to find no fresh sand to spike their imprints and no sea air free of brine or herring calls or mollusks or jellyfish, and fallen down beside them, grieving, as I have on occasion, waiting for water to come in quietly.
And, that's great.
That's Major Jackson reading a poem from his book, Leaving Saturn, and now Eamon Grennan.
And after these two grand poems, I have a tiny wee poem, because one of the things I do love about Whitman is when he settles down and he just looks at one thing and he can see it so clearly. The other thing I love is how sex is everywhere. No matter where Whitman looks, sex rises up major, big time. And so I I have a little poem, but it's so opposite to Whitman on one level, at least, because it's tiny little haiku short lines. And the other just goes down a page. Fuchsia grows in the west of Ireland wild, so it's everywhere around the house where I live there. And you see the bees. So this thing is called Bee Fuchsia. At the first brief lull in terrible weather, bees are back, each entering head first the upside down open, nectar heavy skirts of wet fuchsia flowers, and seeming to stay quite still in that laden inner space. Only the smallest shudder of the two together when the bee tongue unrolls and runs its tiny red carpet into the heart of what is no mystery, but the very vanishing point and live center of the flower's instant, irrevocable unfolding, then stillness again, while this exchange, layer after layer of dusty goodness lipped, given, is taking place, the flower flushed and swelling a little, the bee gently but hungrily clutching.
Yeah, that's very good.
Thank you. Nectar heavy skirt. Eamon Grennan. Now, I thought we would go as Whitman goes, and we'd all read together, Patty Ann, Major, Eamon, and I, the last section of Song of Myself. You know, Whitman tells us, in a certain way, the way all savior figures do, that we'll be able to find him when we need him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the last section of the 1855 Song of Myself.
The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering.
I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world.
The last scud of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shadowed wilds. It coaxes me to the vapor and the dusk.
I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags.
I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles.
You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you, nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood.
Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. You've been listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I've been talking with Eamon Grennan, Major Jackson, and Patty Ann Rogers. Thank you all for joining me. This has been lovely.
Thank you. Oh,
thank you,
wonderful.
Michael.
Thank
lovely,
Michael.
And thanks. It's great. Thanks, Walt.
Thanks, yeah,
Walt.
Right.
Thank Walt, yeah. I've been here at the studios of KSFR. The wonderful operations manager, Sean Conlon, has made this possible for us to use the studio and has acted as our engineer. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Editor, Alan Howard. Technician at KCRW, Mario Diaz. Join us again next week on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.